listening to the Cycling Podcast at the Vuelta a España in association with Rafa. Today we are in Caminito del Rey.
Welcome to a very warm, a very windy Andalusia. My name is Lionel Burney, and it's about an hour or so after the finish of stage two of the Vuelta a España, and I'm with Fran Reyes.
Hi, Lionel.
We couldn't have picked a better spot here, could we? We're at Caminito del Rey. We're overlooking the blue-green water, the brown-green hills. I can see a few wind turbines spinning away over there. It's an oasis of calm, really, compared to the hectic holiday-making coast. You wouldn't believe that this is, what, 45, 50 minutes away from all of the bustle and hustle down on the coast.
Less than an hour drive and you find the real Andalusia, you know, one that is not that prone to tourism, even if it tries to open up, because of course it's a good source of income and stability and money for the people, but that still keeps alive its soul.
It's beautiful. We'll post a picture of our vista on Twitter, I think, because as podcasting venues go, I don't think I've had a finer one this season. I'd have to think hard to think of somewhere that matches this. Well, stage two, Fran. The Vuelta really kicked off today. It was from Marbella to Caminito del Rey, 163.5 kilometres. I love the fact that the Vuelta website described it as flat. It was certainly not flat, was it? It was up and down all day, typical of this countryside, I guess.
Exactly. It's lumpy terrain. I mean, anywhere in Andalusia, if you go inland, you will find lumpy terrain. And this was no exception to that. What it's funny also for me is that these days I was speaking to world officials who told me that today it will be a group of maybe 80 riders to make it together to the finish line. And the cruel reality is that it was a mere 40 or 30 and with several gaps between them.
Well, it was a real hard race at the finish, wasn't it? It was typical fare early on. A break of seven riders went away. Two Frenchmen, Alexis Gougeard of AG2R and Pierre Rolland of EF Education First. A Belgian, Thomas de Gendt, the breakaway specialist of Lotto Soudal. And four Spaniards, Hector Saiz of Euskaltel, Jonathan Lastra.
Not the Euskaltel, come on.
Euskadi.
Euskadi Murias has been trying to differentiate themselves from Euskaltel for a while, and in 1 second, you have thrown all their work away. Come on.
Well, I did that on purpose, Fran, just so that you could explain that the Euskadi team is it's the Basque team that has kind of been coming up in the, not in the flames of the Euskaltel team, but it's trying to re-establish a team that carries the Basque name.
Exactly. I mean, from the flames of Euskaltel, we have Fundación Euskadi in the continental level. It's like the same structure, the same company, same entity that ran the Euskaltel team that has been taken over by Mikel Landa, and they are trying to re-establish that orange color to identify as cycling in the pro ranks. But on the other side, we had the Euskadi Murias team, which is run by a conglomerate of companies, basically into building and civil building, which is Murias Taldea, and they have decided to name the team Euskadi Murias in order to assert themselves as the new visible head of Basque cycling, and they have been first to make it to the Vuelta before Fundación Euskadi, so maybe they have managed to.
And not a bad day for them. They had a rider in the break, as did Cajarual with Jonathan Lastra and BH with Pablo Torres. And the local man, who we'll hear a bit more about later in the episode in part three, Luis Angel Mate of Cofidis. And, well, they got up the road and they had a decent lead, but with 65k to go, it was back down to 3 minutes or so. And at that point, really, Thomas de Gendt decided it wasn't the breakaway for him, so he sat up. With 30k to go, the two Frenchmen were away on their own, Gougeard and Rolland, and then Rolland dropped Gougeard, and then really it all kicked off in the bunch with 16 kilometres to go, under a lot of pressure from Team Sky and Movistar. Big split, Rowan Dennis was caught in it, and then we came up to this finish Caminito del Rey. Not the same approach as a few years ago, the famous stage when Vincenzo Nibali was thrown out for holding on to the team car. That was that day, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. It was that day. No, it was different. It was basically at 3 kilometers to go. You may have noticed that it was a crossroads. So if we had taken left, we would have gone downhill for 500 meters, and then we would have had to climb all that to get back up into this road. That was basically the hill that made the difference that day when Seban Chavez won. But, you know, let's not overlook one fact. You know, it's not only the fact that Team Sky and Movistar team put some pressure, put the hammer down in the head of the bunch, which created the splits. It was also the nature of the roads. They were so twisty, so narrow. You suffered them with the car today, following my wheel. And it's that basically which provoked that any gap that was created into the bunch finished up by cutting the peloton in halves.
Yeah, and the gaps really opened up. At the finish, it was Laurence Dupluis of the Quickstep team who tried what looked for a while a very promising move. He had the wind behind him, which was obviously helping, but in the end, he couldn't hold off Michał Kwiatkowski and Alejandro Valverde. Kwiatkowski of Sky ended the day in the red jersey, but it was Valverde who won the stage, his 10th Vuelta stage win, 38 years of age. His first Vuelta stage win was back in 2003. And as I say, Kwiatkowski in the red jersey. The damage that was done behind, well, there was a group that was at 3 seconds, the Dupluis, Kelderman, George Bennett, Emmanuel Buchmann, Rigoberto Urán, Nairo Quintana and Thibaut Pinot were all in there. Then there was a group at 8 seconds, which was pretty much everyone else. But the people who lost out, surprisingly, Miguel Angel Lopez lost a few seconds, 19 seconds conceded today. Ilnur Zakarin, who had a crash early in the stage, lost a minute and 1 second. Dan Martin, who we know isn't going for GC, lost a minute and 15. Vincenzo Nibali lost 4 minutes and 4 seconds. Well, that proves that my theory that he was going to ghost into contention in the final week, well, that's blown out of the water. Richie Porte, who's been ill, Adam Yates and Rowan Dennis were all in a group, 13 minutes 31 down. So Kwiatkowski in red, just as he was after stage two a couple of years ago. He's also got the green jersey. Luis Angel Mate has got the blue polka dot jersey as King of the Mountains. And not surprisingly, Kwiatkowski is in the combined jersey.
The community around the world. Stories and films with the most compelling characters. The world's finest apparel. Explore the world of cycling with Rafa.
Thank you to Rafa for sponsoring the cycling podcast. I've got my Rafa shorts on today. I've packed for a holiday, really, Fran. Got several pairs of Rafa shorts with me. Just a reminder that if you'd like to ride the Rafa Women's 100-kilometre ride on Saturday, September the 15th, it's going out from the Cadence Performance Store in South London. Have a look on the rafa.cc website for all the details there, and get in touch with the ride leader, one of our listeners, Hannah Nicklin, who will be leading that ride. Now, Fran, Alejandro Valverde, what can we say? I mean, 38 years old, but riding like a man who's 28.
Well, Alejandro Valverde is clearly a guy who never loses his excitement for bike racing. You know, he just loves cycling so much. And this enthusiasm, he transmits it to everyone around him. You know, even when he's doing post-stage interviews, you can feel that he's more or less excited about the fact that he's riding his bike and that he's doing so for a living. So it's not strange that he's in shape the whole year, because he basically does the same training all over the season. From January to October, the amount of kilometers he does in his training rides is more or less the same. You know, he just follows his guts and his instinct, his joy, actually, to prepare himself for racing. Today, in this Vuelta a España, I recall that he's taking a particular kind of pleasure. He defined himself today at the press conference as free as a bird. Like, he doesn't have any role, he doesn't bear any responsibility. Nairo Quintana is the guy for the GC, and if he fails, there is a backup plan with Richard Carapaz, who was fourth on the Giro. So Bala is free to ease up whenever he wants, prepare for the worlds, and aim for particular stages if he feels like.
Well, Carapaz was another who lost a little bit of time today, trying to find him on the results there. Yeah, 2:36 down, I think. No, yeah, that's right. I can't quite... Oh, my eyesight's terrible. Yeah, 2:36, Carapaz was down. But Valverde, he always seems to find himself in these kind of positions. But we know he's very popular in Spain. But what's his... did his reputation take any kind of dent because of the two-year doping suspension he had a few years ago? I mean, it doesn't seem... He got the loudest cheers that I heard, certainly this morning, at the start in Marbella. It seems like he, with the retirement of Alberto Contador, is once again kind of the poster boy of Spanish cycling, still awaiting somebody else to come up.
Well, you know, I'd make a difference here. So, for people who is not that interested in cycling, Alberto Contador remains the most popular rider in Spain, and will be so until Mikel Landa lands a podium on the Tour de France. But as for cycling-interested public, Alejandro Valverde has been superior to Alberto Contador and remains still the top, the most loved rider. Why? Because what he does is really appreciated by whomever who rides a bike, because we can tell how he can do impressive stuff in any kind of terrain, how he's in good shape from the beginning to the end of the season, and the enthusiasm, above all, it's the enthusiasm for cycling, or for the enthusiasm for the bicycle as an object, which makes him different, and what makes him relate to the Spanish public.
Yeah, I mean, Lawrence de Plus and Michał Kwiatkowski both mentioned Valverde, and not just his experience and strength, but just the canny know-how of that finish, because it did kick up a little bit, didn't it, just in the finish there. And Kwiatkowski said, well, he just didn't have what was required for those final 75 metres, and that really was the difference between the two of them. Let's hear a little bit from Lawrence de Plus, who launched a slightly surprising move, and one that lasted a long time. It took some catching.
That was pretty improvised, yeah, because the plan was actually to put Dries Deveneens in a really good position. This finish suits him really well, but I just felt the moment, like, I had some speed from behind. I thought, why not? And in the end, the best two riders in the Vuelta were too strong. And just went full gas to the finish, but Valverde and Kwiatkowski are just from another level. They are world class, so it's not a disappointment for me. Luckily, it was tailwind, so it was a big advantage for me. The prologue yesterday was also good, and today also. So what we see day by day, because it's really hot here in Spain. And in the first part of the race, I suffered a lot. I never felt such a heat in the race before. It was crazy. It's like you're racing in a sauna all day.
De Plus there had the wind behind him, but not quite strongly enough in those final metres. Did well, though, to hang on and finish third on the stage. At the end of this first day of climbing, what have we learned, Fran? Who's in the mix? We know that several people are now ruled out. We know that, for example, Mitchelton Scott, everything is for Simon Yates. Adam Yates lost a lot of time. We know Nibali is more or less out of the picture. But what else struck you from today?
Well, I mean, there have been crashes that have damaged some riders that maybe could have had a shot at the GC, like Zakarin, who is now at hospital after having crashed because of being tangled with Wilco Kelderman falling to the ground. He hit his shoulder. I don't know to which extent his heart, but he lost like a minute and a half today. And Omar Fraile also is bruised, which can also damage the strength of Miguel Angel Lopez's team for the mountains. But well, I think that's pretty early to tell any definitive conclusions, because after all, these the guys who are below the 3 minutes line, the 3 minutes barrier, they are still contenders for top 10, they are still contenders even for podium. But well, definitely there are guys like Wilco Kelderman who look in pretty good shape and pretty attentive. It's normal to see all the riders like the aforementioned Lopez, who lost time, but basically because he's not a punchy rider, so he was going to struggle in this kind of explosive force. I'd say that the only surprise for me today was Carapaz losing time, and Nibali as well. Even if the team told me that they weren't expecting him to lose time today, they were expecting him not to be in contention for the GC and to lose time further down the world, as further down the road, but not today. Apart from that, I think it was pretty envisageable what we saw today, and a bad pun I would love to make. Now that Richie Porte is out of the GC, he has his options of making it to Madrid have increased dramatically, in my opinion.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport.
Beta Fuel, the new superfuel from Science in Sport, is a 2-to-1 maltodextrin to fructose isotonic drink that delivers 80 grams of carbohydrates per serving without upsetting your stomach. This formulation means your stomach can process more carbohydrates per hour than glucose alone would allow. And this could make all the difference to your ride, whether you're cresting the Alpe d'Huez or just crossing the line at your local sportive. Available on scienceinsport.com from July the 12th.
Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you to Science in Sport for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. You can still get 25% off everything you buy there, as long as it's not in conjunction with any other offers. Go to scienceinsport.com, fill your basket, and then when you check out, use the code SISCP25. That's SISCP25. In part two, I'll be joined by Television's Daniel Freeb. Well, Daniel, it's a bit different up here in the Andalusian hills compared to down on the coast, where it's basically flip-flops and shorts and holidaymakers. It's quite remote up here. Beautiful view of the blue-green lake and...
And it's a reservoir, isn't it? I feel like I should have done my homework about this reservoir. It feels like a very, very significant reservoir. The embalse, is it del Chorro? We're very close to a place called El Chorro, and we stayed last year. Were you there or the Buffalo? We stayed in a power station, in a converted power station, on another sort of tentacle of this vast reservoir, which is looking very beautiful this evening.
Go back to my geography A level. Reservoir, man-made. Lake, not man-made. No?
Correct. It's quite straightforward, I think.
very straightforward, yeah. So that presumably is the water source for the towns down on the coast, no?
It is. Talking of water, Lionel, I see you're enjoying a Neste there. I was hoping to talk about lager this evening.
Really? We had the Alhambra last night. Very nice.
Well, I'm glad to say, I think I'm right in saying, you'll have to check this with Fran, that we're moving out of San Miguel territory, because I don't know if you saw, you probably did, when you left Malaga Airport yesterday, or that you were greeted by the sight of the sprawling San Miguel brewery, and San Miguel is very much the local beer in Malaga. Some other good beers in Andalusia, Cruz Campo in Sevilla, and of course Alhambra.
Like all beers that kind of achieve this... this kind of ubiquity, you can have too much of it. I know that's anathema for me to say you can have too much of something, but I was just going to remark on the hills there, what are those plants on there that look almost like cornrows from here?
I think they'd be olive groves. I mean, Andalusia again is almost synonymous with olive growing. We were in Jaén last year, weren't we? Which is I think it's got some self-assigned denomination as the world capital of olive growing, but I can well believe that it's as prolific in terms of growing olives and producing olive oil as anywhere else in the world. They're spaced very far apart here, aren't they, both the vines and the olives? That's because this area doesn't get a lot of water, so they have to take their nutrition from far and wide, line a bit like you.
Unfortunately, the olive groves can't sort of get up and wander down to the reservoir for a drink, can they? They have to rely on what falls out of the sky. Anyway, let's talk about the Vuelta and the standout performance from the first 2 days. Very early days, of course, but I remarked on it in yesterday's podcast, Wilco Kelderman's performance on a course that you wouldn't necessarily say a stick-thin Dutch climber would necessarily go well on.
Is that what we consider Wilco Kelderman's? He's really got the build of a time trialist, hasn't he? But he does time trial well, But it's interesting that you consider him to be a...
Oh, here we go. Well, I was stood next to him feeling like some kind of, you know, sacks of olives that have been gathered from the field compared to him. I think he's sinewy, no? He's a good climber,
sinewy,
certainly.
Sinewy in the same way that all cyclists are sinewy.
True, even the fat ones. Yeah, well, fourth overall last year. A good, well, okay, let me put it another way. Of all of the people that you could imagine standing on the podium, he had the best time trial result yesterday, and then another very good performance today, and looking pretty good.
Well, especially considering he hasn't raced for 2 months. This was... his first race back after a crash in the Dutch Nationals, I think, before the Tour de France. And you would think there would be a bit of ring rust. He might struggle in the first week. I spoke to him yesterday. He's not particularly worried about that if he does struggle in the first week, because this Vuelta is a bit of a crescendo, more than other years, I think. There's slightly less climbing in the first week than certainly there was last year and the year before. So a lot of the guys, particularly the guys who didn't do the Tour de France, I think are really focusing on those last 10 days and hitting peak form then. Wilco Kelderman has been tipped to win this race by George Bennett. George Bennett, another guy who... was very impressive today. I think he finished fifth and looked very sprightly in the finale. Kruiswijk, his teammate, also looked pretty sprightly. But I thought that was a big call, a huge call. Wilco Kelderman to win when, in spite of the fact it might not be quite as mountainous, or it might not have quite the extreme gradients that previous Vueltas have had, it's still very much a climber's race. And I don't consider Wilco Kelderman to be a pure climber. I consider him to be very much an all-rounder, with the dial slightly... tilting towards time trials.
Well, I think he comes out of the Tom Dumoulin mould, doesn't he? You know, flops out of that mould, and well, he wears the same. He's come from exactly the same mould. He's in Team Sunweb. I grabbed a very quick word with him at the finish line a little bit earlier on.
Yeah, I'm back in business as usual. crazy racing. Yeah, the feeling is good. Trained hard, so. I trust also in myself, but you need to see. It's also hot and always different, the race, but it was good first 2 days.
Well, he says it himself there, Daniel, back in business. Certainly a man to watch. And, well, when you consider some of the riders that have lost a lot of time today, Nibali now completely out of it, putting me in my place. My suspicions that this was all putting me in my place there when I thought that maybe this was some kind of elaborate bluff that maybe Nibali would try.
Maybe it's a huge elaborate bluff and he's going to drop the peloton by 18 minutes on the stage to the other side of the Sierra Nevada in a few days.
Well, he doesn't need to make up quite that much time. 4.5, I think he's lost today. But anything else catch your eye today?
I was shocked at how much damage Sky did at the front wheel, Sky and Movistar. The damage they did to certain riders, not others. You know, Matteo Trentin was one of the riders who was tipped for this stage. It looked on the profile as though it might suit some of the climbers who could... The sprinters who could climb fairly well. Trentin is certainly one of those. I spoke to him this morning. He pretty much ruled himself out and said, no, it's much too hard for me, because Mitchelton Scott had recce'd the course and he had seen just how hard it was likely to be. However, he was in the shake-up until, I would say, 2 or 3 kilometres to the finish. So at one stage, it looked as though he might have a go. But... meanwhile, at the back of the peloton, Sagan was getting dropped very early, before the last 10 kilometres. And Rowan Dennis, who I was very confident would be in the lead group at the end, was also getting dropped. And Richie Port, we know about his problems in the last few days. And he's definitively out of the general classification, as is Adam Yates. We thought, well, Adam Yates has been saying that he's here to support his brother. And Mitchelton have got this plan that, well, if they look back at their... Grand Tour results with Chavez and the two Yates brothers, they've always faded slightly, or they've never got better in the second half of the race, and their big goal here is to just improve in the second half of the race, have negative splits, if you like. That's what people...
That's a track racing or time trialing terminology there, Daniel. Yes, you're letting yourself down. Oh dear. Interesting you mentioned Mitchelton Scott there and Adam Yates. Obviously in our final podcast before the Vuelta, Richard spoke to Matt White, and he talked about how they were going to learn a lot from Simon Yates's Giro and ride very differently here compared to how they rode in Italy. I actually spoke to Matt White briefly this morning on a separate subject, the subject of Rowan Dennis, a very talented Australian rider, of course. At the Giro, he missed out on the pink jersey in the time trial in Jerusalem, and then the BMC team launched this coup to take the jersey by leading him out for an intermediate sprint. So he brought the pink jersey back to Italy at the Giro. He's in red here, well, he was in red this morning. And I just wanted to get a sort of another Aussie perspective on Rowan Dennis.
Yeah, look, he's obviously, if there's a year that really suits him to win the world titles, and I think this is the one. He's definitely in the first top three or four individual time trials in the world over pretty much any distance, really, between a short prologue to 40 kilometres. He's in that way, wants to transition to become a three-week rider, a serious one. I think he's potentially one of the best one-week stage race riders in the world because he can put out some good climbing efforts for a climb or a climbing day. His limiting factor there with him making that proper transition there will be his weight. He's just probably that little bit too big to go 3 weeks with these guys. But I think he has no intention of going 3 weeks here anyway. I think you'll see him do 2 weeks and probably go home after the time trial where he'll concentrate on really trying to win the world individual time trial championships. And to his advantage this year, he's probably his biggest rivals have had big years. Like Dumoulin's going to have to back up again after doing the Giro, the Tour, peaking another time. Same with Froome. So I think he's in the driver's seat, and I think this is a very good chance. He's had some bad luck at Olympics and Worlds as well, so a little bit of luck and some good preparation here, and this could be the year.
Yeah, interesting character, Rowan Dennis. Gets results. Matt White there saying that, you know, at the moment, with the seasons that Dumoulin and Froome have both had, Dennis might almost be the favourite going into the World Time Trial Championships in Austria at the end of the month. He called it, really. Rowan Dennis was not going to ride for GC or like a GC rider as he did at the Giro, but he's not a rider that you could ever see in the Australian Mitchelton Scott team. I don't think he would fit in that group, would he? And he's off to Bahrain Merida next season.
On a related note, but slightly different, Matt White's got an opinion on absolutely everything, hasn't he? Not in a bad way, but it's almost as though he goes on his internal iCloud and downloads the Rowan Dennis opinion on Rowan Dennis's prospects in this race file at very high download speed, and it's just there straight away. All right, it reminds me a bit of when I used to do a column with Gianni Savio for Pro Cycling Magazine. I could phone up Gianni Savio and say, Gianni, this month we're doing the column on socialism in Papua New Guinea, and he would instantly, within the next 3 seconds, he would have a very forthright opinion.
Well, after I turned off the tape, Matt White and I talked for another sort of 10 minutes or so about a lot of subjects, the state of French cycling, how there are too many French teams, and how they'd be far better off just having sort of two or three French teams of deeper quality. On the proposed changes to the World Tour, he had some very strong opinions on that. And what I'm going to do, having downloaded all this information, is just pass it off as my own opinions over the coming week.
Maybe we should issue a challenge to the listeners on this world to come up with a topic that Matt White will have no opinions on whatsoever, that will absolutely stump Matt White. We want to hear Matt White say, look, I've got no idea what you're talking about, mate, or I've got no opinion whatsoever on that, mate.
Perfect. Thank you, Daniel.
Don't forget to listen to our morning show, Kilometer Zero, supported by The Economist. Monday, Wednesday and Friday mornings throughout the Vuelta a España.
Kilometer Zero returns tomorrow morning, Monday morning, with a sort of mishmash of Vuelta memories recorded by myself, Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb and Fran Reyes. And that will be on it'll be in all the normal places tomorrow morning. And thank you very much to The Economist for sponsoring the Vuelta series of Kilometer Zero. Now, Fran, on the eve of the Vuelta, we heard some very sad news about a rider who people who were watching cycling at the start of the millennium will remember, Javier Ochoa, probably his most outstanding performance in a Kelme jersey was in the Tour de France in 2000, where he won at Hautacam in the Pyrenees, holding off a rampaging Lance Armstrong to win the stage. He'd been out in front pretty much all day, got over the mountains, and well, so often we see attacks like that reeled in when the GC riders start going hard, but Ochoa held on and really made a big impression with that performance. And then the following winter, 2001, he and his brother Ricardo, who was also a pro with the Kelme team, were hit by a vehicle while out training. Ricardo was killed and Javier was very badly injured and was in a coma for a long time, I believe, and recovered and became a Paralympic cyclist, won gold medals at the Paralympic Games in 2008. And we heard on Thursday night, just a couple of days before the Vuelta, that he had passed away at the age of 43. Now, the reason I'm mentioning this is because he was living in this area. The accident actually happened in this area, and they had a minute's silence yesterday to remember Javier Ochoa before the time trial, didn't they?
Yeah, I mean, just to give you an extent of how important that victory was in Spain, I still keep the newspaper from that day. I mean, I was 9 years old back then. I remember watching the full stage and the following day grabbing the newspaper from my father in order to keep the sheets about what Javier Ochoa had done, you know, because how about he had beaten the big enemy, you know, the owner of the Tour de France, who was Lance Armstrong back then. About the tragical accident that really marked his life and, of course, his sporting career. It happened quite close to the route of today's stage, around the village of Pizarra. A pretty wide section of road, but, well, apparently the driver was speeding and, well, he killed Ricardo and damaged severely Javier. He was from Basque Country, but still they had some summer house here in Malaga, and that's why both of Shoah brothers were training down here back that day. And Javier moved full time here, if I am not mistaken, after the accident, after re-establishing from the accident. He was living in Alorín de la Torre, which is in this area. It's not exactly where the stage finishes tomorrow, if I am not mistaken again, but it's quite close. So yeah, it has been some news that had been hard to swallow. He was still very respected, beloved by the public, and by in the cycling environment, he was perceived as someone who, even when struck by misery, wouldn't give up and would keep riding his bike in order to be happy, above all.
Well, we don't know too much about the circumstances of Ochoa's death, but Spanish press have been reporting that it was after a long illness. And I'm sure that tomorrow, when the stage goes very close to his parents' house, the Vuelta will also take a moment to remember Ochoa. Now, Fran, we've been enjoying the Andalusian countryside all day today. I'm very happy to see another side of this region, because as a Brit, I kind of do associate the Costa del Sol with the water parks and the beer and the beach and well, you can imagine
the beer again.
Well, the beer is fine. As Daniel was mentioning about San Miguel, is obviously the industrial beer from here. No,
yeah, but industrial, but not the biggest quality one, not at all. I mean, in Malaga, the house beer, the beer you should try here, is Victoria, as it defines itself, malagueña y exquisita. Malagueña from Malaga and exquisite. It's very tasty. It is great. I mean, it is to Malaga what Cruz Campo is to Sevilla.
Well, you can imagine, you know, my fair skin, and I'm not one for sunbathing or just lounging around on the beach. So it's been great to see another side of Andalusia. Now, somebody from this region had a big day out today, didn't they?
You're getting red, like the Vuelta leader's jersey, you know?
I put sun cream on today, Fran. I'm trying to stay in the shade wherever possible. But one man in red who had a big day out was Luis Angel Mate, who, well, he's from Marbella. Is he actually from Marbella?
Yes, he's actually from Marbella. He was born in Madrid because of circumstances, but he's from Marbella. In fact, this stage came, basically took the start from his doorstep, you know, so he was the local rider. After the, he obviously made it to the breakaway, as we were saying earlier in the Tale of Tapa, took the mountain jersey, and afterwards we were speaking about the stage, and he told me that right from the moment when he learned the route of the stage, he knew that he was going to attack from the start today, because he knew the climb, the first climb, Puerto de Ojén. Indeed, you know, Luis Ángel Mate, he has a cadet team, a team for riders aged 14 and 15. And this team does their strength and endurance test right in this climb, you know, because it is very steady, roads are very big, not dangerous at all, so they use them for this test. And that's why he went straight on. He sprinted with all he had to beat Thomas de Gendt for the points of the King of the Mountain jersey. And afterwards, he captured point again in Ardales, if I'm not mistaken. So he's in the Polka blue jersey now. He intends to keep it for as long as possible. He knows that tomorrow he has to be in the breakaway because there is 14 points at stake, and the following day in Alfaguara in Granada, at my home, he will be again there, as he promised me.
So a big day out for Mate, riding for Cofidis, of course, been around a long time. And does he live in the area? Does he train around here? I mean, it must be good for training, but especially in the winter, the climate can't be. We're reasonably high here, I guess, but it can't be more than what, a few hundred meters.
Yeah, I mean, we are maybe 500 meters now. Problem for training for him is that he lives in Marbella, and Marbella's roads are pretty busy, you know, and at some points they are pretty narrow, so to get outside of Marbella, that's a kind of a struggle, you know, a half an hour struggle, very dangerous, lot of crossroads. But once he's a bit inland, for example in Ojén, from there on the roads here are beautiful for training. You need to be strong, because believe me, when I lived here and I was on a bad day, I hate Malaga. You know, I hated Malaga because there is uphill and downhill everywhere. You know, but on a good day, you can be the holding the big ring and enjoy yourself. During the season, Luis Ángel Mate used to live up there in Sierra Nevada, because those are the best roads for training in Andalusia and southern part of Spain.
And of course, at altitude as well, which is never, it's never not helpful, is it, for training? We've mentioned the weather and the hot sun. It has been pretty warm here. Fran, you were saying earlier it's not been an exceptionally hot summer in this part of Spain, and in fact this is probably the hottest stretch that they've had. We've been hitting easily mid-30s, I think, but nothing as terrifying and I dread to think what the temperatures at the Tour of Portugal must have been like for the riders. But nevertheless, there were some very hot bodies at the finish here today. Everyone was reaching for a drink immediately. And yesterday, I had a chat with EF Education First nutritionist Nigel Mitchell, and he was talking a little bit about the heat management strategies, because, well, particularly riders who aren't from this part of the world and used to racing in the very warm weather, it can be a bit of a shock to the system.
The most important thing is to try and get as much heat acclimatisation as what you can with the guys. So for 10 days coming into it, we gave them some heat protocol advice, so that basically this really helps to prepare the body for when they come into these really warm temperatures. Fortunately, a lot of the guys were already in hot places, so that's helped a lot. But then what we do, we use things like ice vests. You see them warming up with those on. And these help with some comfort, but they also just help to pull a little bit of heat out of the body. One of the things that's quite popular to help with the heat at the moment is using like ice drinks, slushy drinks. And it's really difficult to try and get these prepared when you're on the bus because you haven't got a commercial machine. So we do these, we just use some of the race drink, and because of the electrolytes in it, it brings the freezing point down a little bit. So the drinks are actually about -3 degrees when the riders are drinking them. And then they've got things like the ice socks down the neck and up the sleeve. So all that is just, it's like a pair of your old granny's tights with ice in them and just put them down. You can see if the heat's been affecting them because you get a drop off in power. They feel very uncomfortable and you get like an increase in heart rate. So, you know, we're not seeing any of that. So it looks like we're managing it well today. Bigger people, bigger riders struggle more because obviously the larger they're producing more power, that generates more heat. Smaller riders, in particular like the Colombians, they don't seem to have any problems at all with the heat. And one of the reasons, again, when people are smaller, because that surface area to volume ratio is different, in effect they can actually lose heat more, but then they suffer more in the cold. So it swings and roundabout. But I don't think we'll be suffering the cold over the next few weeks. And one of the things can be is different terrains. Obviously, when you get to the mountains, you get a lot of radiant heat coming up off the road. So it might be, let's say, only 30 degrees, but when you get that radiant heat coming up, then that really increases it. They aim to get through about 2 bottles per hour, about 1 litre per hour. They tend to be quite good. It's amazing how much water, how much fluid they get through. Just on the training ride over the last few days, so we had 8 riders and they were making up 60 bottles and they're going out for 3 hours training and basically it all went.
Well, Fran, I'm thinking of getting myself an ice vest, maybe, if it gets any hotter. I could wear an ice vest and then go and do my interviews, keep cool, and then get back in the air-conditioned car.
Yeah, you know what the good part about that? If you can get closer to the riders because they will want to hug you. You know, because you will be cold, you know.
I'm seeing the downsides of this now.
No, it's not a downside. I mean, girl, I love the riders. I mean, they do so much for us. They do so much to entertain us. The less we can do is to give them some coolness.
Indeed. Well, it's cooling down a little bit now. I think it must be ready for a post-podcast Malagan beer, I think. Maybe head back down to Malaga and enjoy the rest of the evening. Things will just be getting started as we arrive.
Yeah, we will make it to Malaga at 9 p.m. or less, so yeah, that's about the time for dinner, for ordering dinner. And you know, does a stick sound good for you?
Perfect. I mean, I've only been here a day and a half and already I'm getting into the Spanish groove. And we'll be back in the groove again tomorrow at the end of stage 3. Until then, Fran, thank you.
Thanks, Lionel.